The Future of Teamwork is a Huddle 3 production for Leader. Subscribe today and never miss an episode. Welcome to The Future of Teamwork, the show where we explore fresh perspectives and practical ideas to help leaders build healthier, more resilient, high-performing teams. Today's episode is part of a special 5-part Leader Lab series, and we're doing something a little different. As you listen, we'll invite you to step into the shoes of our guests by reflecting on 7 real-world leadership challenges. It's a chance to compare your thinking to theirs and learn something new about your own leadership style along the way. To help you go deeper, we've included a brand new leadership development exercise in the show notes. It's called How Do You Leader? And it's a short set of reflective prompts you can work through on your own or with your team. Think of it as a leadership workout designed to stretch your thinking and strengthen your impact. Now, let's get into it. Today, Dane speaks with Bullhorn CEO, Art Pappas, a leader known for his bold and often contrarian take on change. This conversation touches on everything from navigating mergers to balancing autonomy and team cohesion to supporting those who feel like outsiders. It's a rich, honest chat, and we think you'll come away with some fresh insights into how you lead under pressure. And don't forget, all the resources, including the How Do You Leader exerciser in the show notes. Let's dive into episode 1 of the Future of Teamwork Leader Lab series, The Healthy Art of Managing Change. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. Today, we're diving into a Leader Lab with Art Pappas. Art is the founder and CEO of Bullhorn, which is a software platform for the staffing and recruiting industry. And I've actually met Art, I think the first time was years ago at the SIA conference in Phoenix. It was probably like 2015, 16. So the world's changed a lot since then. It's good to be reconnecting.
Yeah, good to reconnect.
So let's jump right in. Where would you say some early positive influences emerged for you around teamwork?
I'm a big fan of the Lencioni book, The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team.
Yeah.
I got introduced to that in 2005, and I read it and thought, okay, this is pretty good, and tried to incorporate some of it. And then again in 2012, somebody said to me, you need to read this book. And I said, oh, I have read it. And he said, you know what? I don't know that you've absorbed it, because the behaviors I've observed in watching you and your team, I don't think you guys have mastered some of the concepts in the book. And that was actually really good critical feedback. And it actually came from a guy who was our private equity sponsor, which you wouldn't think of somebody in private equity as being focused on like teamwork and collaboration. And, you know, usually they're financially oriented. And he clued in on some like team dynamics that were unhealthy back in 2012.
That's very cool. It's funny you say that, Art, because I've seen, you know, having a number of friends in the PE world, a shift over the last 5 to 10 years where a number of PE firms are now saying what makes us different is we're not just the financial engineers and architects. We're actually here to look at healthy teams and strategy and go to market. And I'm seeing it probably more in the teamwork sphere than not.
Yeah.
With Lencioni's work, what was it that stood out to you? Like for people who may not be familiar with the book, what just was, as a leader who's busy, who's growing businesses, what just popped for you and like, oh, I can do that?
It's a really simple book. You can read it in probably about 3 or 4 hours, I think. And it boils down the essence of teamwork to, it's all about trust. But how do you define trust, and what does it actually mean in the business context of being a team? And I think there's the notion that, you know, are you able to be vulnerable with your teammates and say things like, I don't know what I should do, or I am struggling with this, or I need input. And that's people, oh, you know, of course I asked for input. What do you think of this? But it, to truly be vulnerable and say, team, I'm wrestling with this because I don't know what the right answer is different than saying, hey, I want to show this to everybody for their input, which is like, don't give me any input. I'm basically just doing you a courtesy of showing you what I'm about to do. And I think that's like one aspect of it. It talks about commitment to doing the things that you say you're going to do, Or do you just say, oh yeah, we should do that, but you have no intention of following through and actually making that happen? And it talks about how those sorts of interactions that lead to people saying they're going to do things and not doing them really erodes trust and really creates like horrible team dynamics. And similarly, when teams set goals, are they really committed to the goals? And so we can say, oh yeah, we have a goal of selling 1 million units by the end of the year, but nobody really knows how we're going to get there. And it seems kind of lofty. And, you know, you first have to get to 100,000 units. And how do you get there? And nobody's like said, well, if in order for us to do that, we're going to have to solve this problem with the product or this problem with our distribution or this problem with our sales or our pricing. And that's where great teams get into it with each other and say, I can't sell 1 million units as head of sales because we have very unhappy customers. Oh, okay. Well, we have unhappy customers because sales is telling them it can do things that it can't do. Oh, well, it should be able to do that. And the customers expect it. They won't buy unless it does. And then you have conflict. And the conflict is really important. And this is where, and it has to be healthy conflict, not like your product sucks, you stink. You know, it needs to be like, I'm getting this feedback from the customer and I don't know how to get around it as an obstacle. Okay, well, one answer is we need the product to address it. Another answer is, well, have you tried saying this to the customer or that, or pointing out that these negotiations can sometimes feel uncomfortable, but they're critical to success in business. And a team is really good at having those negotiations and saying, you know, I think it's a marketing issue. Oh, okay. Well, let's debate that. Like if I'm the customer, I'm not going to be persuaded by your argument. You are saying that, Mr. Product Person, but like, I think the customer won't be persuaded. Okay. Yeah, you're right. I guess we have to address this with a change to the product. And that's how you get to a place where you build a winning product and you don't build too much product that nobody needs. And yes, you ensure that your sales team is properly positioning the value of the thing that you have and your marketing is aligned to the messaging that's going to resonate with the customer because everybody's thought about what they know about the customer and what will and won't work. And you don't get everything right 100% of the time. But when you have a team that can do all those things, trust each other, meets their commitments, when they say they're going to do something, they do it, and they feel accountable to each other, you get really great results.
Yeah. I love the way you've explained that. There are a couple of pieces I'd love to replay. I know when you said building trust as a leader, like don't just show someone something. You know, the language you used is, hey, I'm struggling with this. Can you give me your perspective or input? I think that's hugely inclusive, but it's real too, which I think a lot of leaders can fall into the trap of not having that authentic engagement or belief in, you know, the power of the collective team versus, you know, their brain's trust, wherever they're calling on that from.
I think executives really struggle with this, and they struggle because when you are new in your career, it's totally okay to admit you don't know how to do something. And once you become a leader, you're expected to lead. And so people train their minds around, if I don't know the answer, I need to fake it till I make it, which can work, especially in lower levels of leadership. And then as an executive, you're definitely not supposed to admit that you don't know the answer.
Particularly if you've got private equity breathing down your neck.
That trap is really dangerous. And I think it snares a lot of people on their ascension up the leadership ranks. And it's a reason a lot of people fail is they're just afraid to say, I don't know the answer. I don't have experience in this particular pattern set, so I don't know what to do. And I'm thinking about this, but that could be wrong. What do you think? But to do that allows the people around you to say, oh, that's a terrible idea. Don't do that. I saw somebody do that in my last job, and here's how that ended. Or why wouldn't you do that? That's a fantastic idea. And then you get reinforcement and positive feedback about your idea, and or they add to it and they take it in another direction. And it's like, that's collaboration, that's teamwork, versus keeping all your problems to yourself. That's like, that makes a mess.
It does make a mess. And for those leaders, and I've certainly been one of them at times, let's be honest, periodically, because you can't always throw it out. When stress happens to you, you can very easily fall into that trap of, I've got to have the answers. I'm just going to shut my door and push through this. And it feels really heavy. But if you can run into that stressful moment and have the belief in your team and say, hey, team, we've run into this problem. Let's bring a bit of a war room together and just bounce some ideas around on, like, where might the problem even be coming from before we try and solve it. It can actually just dissipate a lot of that stress and tension and get people more in that creative mindset.
No, you're absolutely right. The moment that you need to be the most vulnerable is the moment that your instincts tell you to be the opposite.
Yeah.
I'm really not sure what to do. Here I am sat in this executive role where I'm supposed to know what to do. And the last thing I want to do is say, I don't know, publicly in front of my peers. And so what I do is I pretend I know what to do and I make a stupid decision. And then everybody's like, that was dumb. And I knew it was dumb. And it's like, and that just erodes trust. And people are like, this person is not good at their job. And why am I working with these people? They're not good. And it's funny, the reason that this particular board member at the time made that observation with me was, he said, your board meetings are like congressional testimony, where somebody's sitting in front of a board of directors and saying, here is what happened in my department, and we did this, and the results were that, and these are our goals for next quarter, and we will be working on them because these are important. And nobody from the other departments or other team members says a word. And then it moves on to the next department. And there was no collaboration, interaction, or any sort of sense that it's a team. He said it's a collection of individuals doing jobs.
Yes.
And that was like, he just had that observation. He said, read this book. And it took about 4 years to be able to truly master it. And some of it was just like in the book, it tells a story through an allegory. And in the story, this CEO has to let go of the head of marketing because they just can't embrace this notion of trust and being vulnerable and being accountable. And so I had to go through a similar journey. I had people on my team who, I had one executive tell me, this is an anathema to me. The whole notion of having a public disagreement in a group setting is offensive to me. And when I say something and one of my peers disagrees in a group setting, that's humiliating. And this guy had spent time in Japan.
Very different culture.
And yes. In Japan, that would be the end of my career if I were crossed by somebody, especially a superior. And I said, well, we're not in Japan. So, and I believe that this is going to lead to better outcomes. And so if you don't feel comfortable with that, I'm not sure this is going to work. And sure enough, it didn't. And that's okay.
Yeah. In fact, it's great. It's good for you and it's good for him probably.
Yeah, he didn't die. He went on and went somewhere else where they were okay with that kind of culture. I don't think you need it. It's not like you need it to win. We were actually a pretty successful company at that point. But I think we're more successful now.
Yeah, that's cool. And I'm going to dive into that, but that kind of now and some past big achievements. But I've got this book behind me, which I smile when you talk about the way that that person chose to work or preferred to work. And the book's Wrong Fit, Right Fit by Dr. Andre Martin, who's now a close friend. He was head of talent at Google and Nike and Mars and some cool brands, Target. But a big part of his book and his research is some people like to work in a certain way. Maybe that's because of cultural upbringing. Maybe that's, you know, just innate personal preference. But if they like to work in a particular way, it actually drains their energy if they have to conform to a different work culture. So he actually, and I'm paraphrasing, but he advocates heavily for, going back to your point here on we're a better team now, we're doing great work now. If you're very clear on the way you work, the way you set your culture out around things like trust and commitment and clarity, and then you hire for people that work the way you work, then there's so much more energy on the team and you're so much more capable of, you know, achieving big milestones and events.
That's interesting. I think people can adapt the way they work, but the older you get, the harder it is.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. And to that point on adapting, if you're clear in your workplace about, hey, this is how we have meetings, tackle conflicts, set goals, then people can adapt because you've given them a bit of a pro forma. You haven't told them how to do their job. It's not micromanaging, but you're building some appropriate sort of guardrails for how we're going to go forward.
You know, I've tried that. I've tried to tell people, this is how we operate. And you should read this book because it's going to be helpful to you in understanding our operating structure. And intellectually, people understand it. But until you actually are dropped into an environment like that for the first time, it's sort of like reading a book about like being in a battle, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's different when the bullets start different. Flying.
And for the first time, you're in a meeting and somebody says to you, I don't think that's going to work. And whoa, did you that? Like you get flush of embarrassment. And all of a sudden, you're ashamed that like you've been embarrassed in front of your peers. Now, the fifth or sixth time it happens, and then you've done it to somebody else just because you're looking out for the best interest of the team. That takes a while to get used to. And so I think at first people find it very unsettling and then they get used to it. And that's just part of, oh, like, you know, she said that to me, but it doesn't mean that she doesn't respect me. It just means that she doesn't think the idea is a good idea. I'm detached from my ideas. My ideas are, yes, that's like my idea. I have it, but like somebody else can say it's not good. It doesn't mean I'm not good.
Yes.
All of my ideas are terrible and nobody wants to do anything I suggest, then maybe I am not good. But, you know, like if I'm, you know, 50% hit rate on my ideas, that's pretty good.
You're batting better than most major league batters.
Yeah, that's right.
That's very cool. And I really like the analogy of like, you can't read a book about being in battle and just be there. So that's very cool. Just shifting gears, you being a leader in the software space is very interesting because my observation, not having run big software companies, is you've got this really cool team of teams dynamic between sales and product and the various other functions that you've got. If you think back over the period that you've been there, and you know you've been there from early days startup right through to scaled success. What would you say is one of the bigger achievements that you've navigated as a team?
Oh God, there's so many achievements, you know, over time, over 25 years, it's like, it's hard to catalog and sort.
Well, no absolute. So you can just pick a good one. It doesn't have to be the best.
Yeah, I think there've been a number. I think the leap from venture-backed company to private equity was really, really tough and was an intense transition. And that was a period of time where we had to go through a lot of change as a team. And I'm particularly proud of how we exited that. And it took about 3 years to sort of like build the team culture and dynamic. But like, that is one of like, as a leader, that's to me, one of the best experiences. And at that time we had a really negative customer experience and our net promoter score was really low at that time. And our employee morale was really low. And yet the company was very successful. It was this like paradox of like, okay, company growing 45% a year, just had a huge exit to private equity, very successful, 150 employees, but yet the customers and the employees aren't happy.
That
was sort of like really strange. And once we changed the team dynamic and we figured that out, all of a sudden, some of our challenges around customer experience became clear. And the product leader was able to say, this is what we need to do to the product to make the customers happy. And once the customers felt happier, that improved the morale of the entire team, from sales to customer service. And that had this like virtuous cycle effect of like, oh, we should do more of this. We should listen to our customers and really be tuned into the feedback they're giving us. And it didn't take like a monumental shift of like, oh, we had to like create some new invention. And we just had to invest in the right way. We were investing in the wrong things previously and building products to expand what we had versus shoring up the things that we already had that were good. And so I think that was like a really pivotal moment. Another pivotal moment was learning how to acquire and integrate companies and get good at that. We've acquired somewhere between 15 and 20 businesses in the last decade. We try to do two or three a year. And I think that's a skill, and learning as a company to have that skill. Another one is like becoming a multi-product company. Like most companies that find success with one product find it very difficult to launch a second product. And I think we as a team navigated that together. And there were all these different challenges that we had to unlock together as a team. And it's like, okay, why isn't it working? Why won't the salespeople sell it? Oh, because nobody believes that it can be sold. And how do you overcome that? Okay, we just have to sell the first three and then make a lot of noise internally about how great this was and how easy it was to sell and how happy the customer is. And learning how to market to your own employees for the first time, you know, is like a really interesting dynamic. And you wouldn't think, oh, you have to market to your employees, but you really do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're competing for their attention and you know, they've got customers telling them what to do and they have their own goals personally, and it's important stuff. And so those are some of the milestones that like I look back on, like those are really great.
There's some material milestones over time. It's interesting when you touch on marketing to your employees, because a lot of the work we do on the podcast talks about the importance of storytelling. And for me, I'm not a marketing expert. I'm far from it. The way I've ever achieved marketing results was really going to conferences and buying people beers and telling stories in person. Never been very digital. But there's a truth there that if you're telling stories to your employees, then I believe that the research and the science says if someone hears the same version of a story from three different people, it kind of locks it in. It creates belief and trust. So there's a lot there that I think in teams today, particularly in remote and hybrid work settings, we can probably all be doing a lot more internal storytelling, whether it's around a product or whether it's around an internal change in process or any number of things.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. The whole notion of like marketing as a, you know, glossy, flashy thing is like, yeah, that works for consumer products. But I think that when it comes to leadership and marketing to employees, being authentic and then telling a relatable story is important.
Yeah. We had a guy on the show, Francisco Mafuz. He talked about story circles. It goes both ways, because you mentioned, you know, what's motivating my employees? Well, let's hear my employee stories, because that might tell me what's important to them, you know, within the business or outside of the business, that we can help channel and harness, you know, as a company. I've always loved that if you look at companies holistically, they're not just here to serve shareholders and customers. They're actually here to serve employees when they go home at the end of the day too.
Yeah, totally.
Cool. All right. So let's jump into just a quick snapshot on philosophies on teamwork. Then I think we touched on it from your early influences, but if you had to boil it down to like one or two key philosophies as you're going forward, if there's a leader on the show listening and saying, hey, this is what Art thinks around teamwork, what would you say those one or two philosophies would be?
My philosophies are pretty simple. Like it all kind of boils down to this stuff I was talking about teamwork and leadership. Another thing that has been an element of that I found really successful is focusing on behaviors of your employees that you want to value and reward. people talk about core values, and I think, you know, everybody's read Good to Great and how companies have strong core values. I think they scratched the surface on that, and I don't know that they really went to the full extent to understand why those values were important. It wasn't until I read Jack Welch Winning that I really kind of got my arms around, like, oh, it's really about behaviors that you want to value. And I'll say that some of what Jack Welch presented in that book was really helpful to me, but other bits of it I have not found helpful. Like focusing on, like, I want employees with edge and they should be driven. And like, that's really hard to quantify. How do you interview for that? And like, it always felt a little forced to me, and more of like Jack being like, I want employees who remind me of me.
Yeah, it's the ego speaking.
Yeah. And but if you step back and you say, like, okay, what are the behaviors that I want my employees to do regularly? And we've spent a lot of time on this, and we hone this all the time. And we've got five sort of buckets of behaviors. Some are around interacting with customers or peers. Some are around accepting feedback and how you deal with feedback, how you give feedback. Some are around the relationships that you form, and some are around commitment and doing what you say you're going to do. And it's like, so we have five, and we call them core values, but they're really not values as much as they are very prescriptive sentences that are like, you know, do what you say you're going to do, how you say you're going to do it, when you say you're going to do it.
Brilliant.
Always respond in a timely manner. And don't leave people hanging. Leave people feeling that you care about doing a great job for them, whether or not you can solve their problem. And then, you know, reset expectations when you can't meet them.
Yeah.
Before the deadline. Like stuff like that. It's very explicit. And it's like, behave this way and Bullhorn will reward you. And if you don't, then you may not be a fit to be here. And by the way, we can all change our behavior, right? You can change whether or not you're an introvert or an extrovert, or you're aggressive or conflict adverse. Like that's kind of hardwired, but I don't like saying that I'm going to hire a team of all aggressive people or all conflict adverse people. Like you need a mix, because if everybody's just constantly like punching each other in the face in a meeting or not saying anything in a meeting, that's not super productive. And so it's, you know, it's all about a mix. It's all about a balance. But everybody should be able to take constructive feedback and not turn it into like a counterattack. That's really important. Like you can love conflict and you can love mixing it up, but if somebody says, hey, the way you handled that was not good and that made me feel like shit, well, okay, how do I react to that? Do I attack back or do I reflect and say, okay, yeah, thanks for the feedback. I appreciate you telling me. I'll be more mindful next time. Like if you can do that, then great. You can work a bullhorn.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I really appreciate the accessibility of behaviors, which are broadly prescriptive without telling you how to do your job. And it reminds me, I know the Ritz-Carlton, who are known for running great service, they used to have a set of behaviors for their team. So an example would be, hey, if a guest comes and asks you where the restrooms are, don't just point and say second corridor on the left. Like we don't point, we walk our guests to where they need to get to. And so little behaviors like that really set up the whole framework of teamwork.
Yeah, they need to modify that though. I don't really want somebody walking into the bathroom. Like,
good point. There's probably a better example that they might.
No, it's a good example because it's better than what most people do and it stands out.
Yeah. So let's jump into a hypothetical then. You talked about mergers and acquisitions and you've done a bunch. So let's say there's a leader out there right now that's just made an acquisition and they're having to dive into the integration. And often what'll happen when you're integrating a business is the team's like, hey, we used to be this and now we're something else. Where does that leader start? What might be a good place to start a conversation, you know, okay. Who might they engage with?
I have a controversial take on this, that we take an opposite approach to what I think most people do. What most people try to do is placate and allay fears and concerns that things are going to change. You'll find that we have a great culture and the two cultures are very similar. And, you know, we're really going to take the best of your culture and the best of ours and put it together. And that's not true. It's almost never true. The acquiring company has a culture, and that culture is going to prevail. And the more you pretend that that's not the case, the more you erode trust with your new employees that you've just acquired. So we take a different approach and we say, take a moment and celebrate the company that you were part of, that has been acquired and has reached this amazing milestone of reaching an acquisition and sale to another business, and celebrate the culture that you created that led you to this point. Now, once you're done with that, you know, take a week or whatever it takes, really you need to get in the mindset of you've taken a new job at Bullhorn. You've just started at Bullhorn. You accepted the job. And in fact, you can even decide, I don't accept this job. I don't like the notion of working for a company this size. We'd like to know that. But if you're open to it, take the thought that this is a new culture, a new company, new set of norms that you have to learn, and behave as if you would if you joined a new employer. You would not, upon joining a new employer, try to stage an insurrection and say, the culture is all wrong and we need to change it and it needs to be like the company that I used to work for. You would try to assimilate to the new culture and the new norms. And when people hear that, they get upset. And I like to front load the getting upset part, because the faster they get upset and mourn the loss of the old culture and the old job, the better chance you have of every day from there gets better versus the other way, which is every day gets worse because you've made a promise and then
death by a thousand cuts.
Inch by inch, they find out it's not true. And so I just give them all the bad news on day one and say, okay, now you're part of Bullhorn. And now every day is good news. And, oh, okay, I really like this culture. I can see why they do it that way. That's cool. They get things done. We went as a team together. Like, oh, okay. I was in a meeting and there was a bunch of conflict, but then we ended up with a better outcome. And it's like, they're more open to it when you start it that way. It's not perfect. There's no perfect way to do it, but I prefer to front load the bad news and then and trust that people aren't going to jump ship right away. And it's just being honest.
I love the honesty and the authenticity, to be honest, Art, because I've been on the buy side of a few acquisitions in the past, and I've intentionally gone in wanting to take the best parts of two cultures and put them together. But that's a high wire act. Like, you're not in control of picking which pieces you want and putting them together in a nice plant that's a hybrid. Like, a lot of it's just going to emerge and evolve from the humans that are there, and that's a tricky one.
If you're a 300-person company buying a 50-person company, getting 300 people to change is a lot harder than getting 50 people
Great
to
point.
Change. And that's the inertia will just, it's like a physics problem where the smaller object will be the one that absorbs the impact.
Yeah, that's very true. And I also like the one step of the pain. Like, one of my great friends, Eric, he'll always say, hey, if we're making a change, how can we compress all of the tough stuff into just one step rather than make a partial change and then 6 months later, once they get settled, hit them with another one and another one? So I just love that compression.
Our COO and president always says that. He says, bad news all at once, not in phases and doses. It's true. It's hard because people worry as a leader, can they handle all of this at once? Like, I need to change this and I need to take away that. And people like this thing that we used to do. You just have to do it all at once because they can absorb it, as opposed to, like, it seems like every 3 months they change something for the worse. Seems like this company just always does that. Just don't want that.
That point of celebrating the company that you came from, I love the way you frame that. And then having that realization, even if you need a bit of time, that, hey, I just took a new job here, I get to embrace what's here. I think that's very interesting. One of my therapists that I've worked with in the past, when I talk about, hey, I'm worried about the employees, she'd always be like, well, is it your job to protect them through that emotional journey? It's a growth opportunity for them. Like, don't be an empath and take everything on for them, because you're limiting their ability to do the celebration or do the grief or do whatever it is that as humans they're more than capable of doing.
That's a very important lesson, and I agree with that advice. I oftentimes throughout my career as a leader would really struggle to give people feedback because I worry about how they're going to feel about it. And then you're right. It's like nobody likes to be told they're not doing a good job and not meeting the mark for their boss. But when you hear that for the first time, you grow and you realize, okay, I have to change. And that's like an important thing. And it's like, would I want somebody to pretend that everything was fine and tiptoe around me? No, I'd want somebody to tell me this was not what I'm looking for at all. Like, here's what I need. And it's like, okay, that's a mindset shift, and stop trying to protect people. And even like, if you have to let people go, they got to grow from that, and they will either learn from it or they'll repeat the same mistakes over and over again, but that's on them and that's their journey. And your journey as a leader too, is to learn how to deal with that in an empathetic way and in a way that lets them preserve their dignity. But it's on them to learn the lesson, and you can't shield them from it. And it's really, really great. I totally agree.
Well, you nailed that. That's one of the best hypotheticals we've ever done. So thank you. Okay. We're sliding into the back end of the conversation. So the lightning round, I'll just ask sort of three or four quick fire questions. In your mind, how do you balance individual autonomy with collective success on a team?
That's where the behaviors come back in. So the behaviors are sort of the guardrails about like what's acceptable. And if you allow people to be creative, but live by the behaviors, then that's a good guide.
Love it. That's a great answer. How can team members push each other to improve without creating unhealthy friction or tension?
Yeah, it's all on how you deliver the feedback, right? You can use words like I feel or I think, as opposed to declarative statements like this sucks.
Yes. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. Like, I don't think this marketing campaign is going to resonate with our customers is much better than this is a horrible marketing campaign, right? People can accept, like, I don't think this is going to resonate. People can accept that.
Yeah. I like that.
Saying what you think and making sure it's clear that this is your opinion is a lot better. Or this made me feel, you said this and it made me feel that you don't think, you know, the product team is responsive to customers. And that, like that, oh, okay, when I said that, I didn't mean it that way. Like, you disarm people before you give them the feedback, right?
Yeah, that actually works well in my marriage too. If my wife ever tells me that something that I did made her feel a certain way, I pay a lot more attention than if she's like, what is that? So that's real. And then favorite way to celebrate team success?
Storytelling, telling the story and like setting up the hero's journey. We thought we were going to do this, and then we set out, and then it got really hard, and we almost like lost everything, and we were in peril. But then this happened, and so and so saved the day, and like those stories are great. People love that.
Yeah, they're awesome. Do you do that in a in-person like meeting environment, or do you do videos within your team, or how do you convey stories?
We because we're global. We do a lot of that. Via video, and usually it's in a town hall setting where people are live.
Nice. That's very cool. And last one, what's one piece of advice for someone who feels like an outsider on the team?
Someone who feels like an outsider. I think at Bullhorn, the best way to get accepted is to live by these behavioral guides, the five pillars of behaviors that we have. And I don't often hear people say that, like, I'm an outsider. I think it, now some groups are really tight. Like, I've worked with a lot of my direct reports for a long time. So it can be kind of hard to like come in fresh. And there can be a lot of like acronyms and
jargon
to learn. So that can be a little bit of a tough ramp. And so to be fair, like people can feel like, okay, I'm not yet able to speak the language, but that just takes time, you know, especially the more complex the business, the longer people have been doing it, the more they know the jargon. And usually we're hiring people from within those roles, and it makes it easier. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess a buddy can always help then too. Like there's certain things you're not going to be comfortable asking your boss about, but go find a buddy in the org and ask more questions.
But actually to that point, we've just hired two new executives from the outside, and they're both asking a lot of questions. And that means they're learning and they're saying what they don't understand. Like, what you guys said, VMS three times. What is that? Oh, okay. Of course you don't know what that is. And most people sit in meetings pretending they know what these acronyms are. You don't necessarily stop the meeting, but afterwards write it down and say, I didn't know what this was. I lost the conversation because I don't know what a VMS is. Yeah. What is that?
Sorry. That's one of the times that I don't mind my team members like getting on ChatGPT mid-meeting, because if there's a flow of conversation, you don't want to stop for the question, but ChatGPT might give you a pretty quick response.
Yeah.
It's been a great conversation, Art. I love the reference to Lencioni's book. I think your framework around behaviors is a huge kind of flashing light for me. Like, yes, it resonates. It's very achievable. It applies to everyone at every level of an organization. So I think that's the huge takeaway from today. And I really appreciate your time in sharing your insights and experience.
Thanks. This was great.
Thank you for tuning in to today's special Leader Lab episode. Don't forget to check out the show notes and the How Do You Lead exercise. Also, if you're looking for a fuller development program, connect with our team effectiveness or coaching specialists to learn more about your options at leader.com. That's LEAD, the number 3, R.com. Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.